Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name's Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have Ricardo Badia, who is from Spain. He did his PhD in agroengineering at the Polytechnic University of Madrid. But he really focused on food supply chain, cold chain and more specifically, and food waste. He's really an expert in food waste, cold chain, and improving food security through that route. He's done a lot of consulting all over the world, helping companies improve their supply chains and reduce waste. And he recently started his own consulting firm called Fresh Impact. So we're really pleased to have Ricardo join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great. So you want to correct anything I said about you or clarify, give us an overview of your expertise?
Yeah, no, everything you say is absolutely perfect.
And great.
just to give you what you say, a little bit of background of my expertise, agroengineering is many things. You can work in many, many fields. But when I was finishing my degree in the university, I got an internship in like more advanced, like sensors and more technical part of the agro engineering, because you do like more plants and that kind of stuff. But I specialize more in the sensors area. Mm-hmm. So I work basically at the beginning measuring the temperature and other parameters like light, relative humidity in the cold chain.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was super interesting because it's something that we usually don't see. We don't see what's behind what it takes to get like a clamshell of strawberries. Mm-hmm. You know? So
right.
As engineers, we can be in the field and we can see how things are growing, but everything that is between that and what takes it to put those strawberries into the supermarket or your fridge was a mystery, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
After finishing my degree, I could go to University of South Florida as an intern and work in a couple of projects. Super interesting. One was for military rations, also involving the supply chain and expiration dates and how to improve the logistics, and also strawberries for Walmart.
Mm.
We did a project, also very interesting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I can tell you more.
Yeah.
if
there's a lot there, we can go back.
Yeah, because I've been working with berries basically after that my whole life, professional life. Then after that, I went back to Spain to get the PhD, and during this period, it was 2 years that I got to spend 6 months in China working in a company.
Mm-hmm.
That is designated by the government to do all these cold chain and food supply chain issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I was helping them to develop like very innovative cold room chamber that measures and can control the humidity and everything. And I was helping them to, you know, better understand what they were building. And that
Great.
Was super enriching and really, really nice to spend these 6 months learning their culture, learning how they work. And then coming back to Spain, finishing my PhD, and then I got a couple of projects here in Europe about the food supply chain, and I thought that what I was doing was actually causing a reduce in the food waste, because every measure you apply to improve either the supply chain or the cold chain ends up on wasting less food.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to join efforts with a company in California. It's called Zest Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this solution to help companies from producers to supermarkets, groceries, no matter the size, they have this solution that they can implement. They can read all kind of parameters, and I was helping them to understand what was the shelf life of the product, to put that into a software. And when you are able to measure the shelf life and the quality of the product at any stage, you can better manage the product. Mm-hmm. And that's what I have been doing these last 3 years. But now, since I started the Fresh Impact firm, I thought I need to do something else that goes into society, let's mm-hmm. say. I'm not Jesus Christ or anything like that. I'm thinking everything I know, I need to transfer to the society. So I go to a co-working space, and they organize talks, and I say, can I talk about food waste? And they say, of course, mm-hmm. Everybody likes food waste. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Nobody likes food waste, everybody likes food. So, yeah. Super, I put together, yeah, everybody eats, like 3 times a day or 2 times or 5 times a day. And they open their fridge and they find something that is rotten or spoiled, and they think, what am I doing wrong here? And maybe it's not their fault, maybe it's becoming before that. So I want to do more of these talks to schools, to work centers, anywhere. So that's why. And I have other aside projects, like insect farming. I'm advising a company that is about to, to have their insect farm, and other projects that I want to develop for helping people with my knowledge.
Wow, there's so much you said there. That's so interesting. So just to clarify for me even, and for other people who maybe don't know the word cold chain, that's typically referring to a food supply chain that transports products that need to be kept cold, such as fresh produce.
But that could also apply to things like milk and dairy products too, or
and vaccines. Sure.
Oh, vaccines. Interesting.
Yeah, everything that requires to be kept under certain temperature.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, I didn't even think about vaccines, and right, of course, dairy and things. Yeah, so you said you worked a lot with sensors, which is really cool, like temperature, looking at temperature, light, and humidity. And then you also did a lot of stuff with software to look at shelf life. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just sort of everything.
Just sort of summarizing the main points here. And then you got really interested in also like the consumer, just how, first of all, how food supply chains affect food waste. And then there's a consumer piece to food waste too, but you're focusing more on the supply chain aspect. But you also, I think there's also definitely a consumer aspect. It sounds like you're kind of interested in both, sort of really now focused on the food waste angle, which is very hot topic right now.
Because it's connected, right? And I learned that doing my job, and I didn't think about that before.
Right.
It certainly makes a lot of sense. So here's an important sort of issue that I think we should bring up. You've been to a lot of different places, and that's something that makes me wonder initially, how do the different countries or different companies, different organizations treat their supply chains or their cold chains? You know, you've got now experience, you can talk about China, the US, and Europe. So what are the core differences there?
Well, for example, in Europe, it's all about getting the product on time, no matter what the manners. I mean, they have their trucks here, they refrigerated trucks and everything, but they just want to deliver the product. I'm kind of, let's say, intoxicated in the good manner, because Spain is a huge producer of fresh produce. Spain mm-hmm. is the vegetable garden of Europe, mm-hmm. and we are the biggest exporter of fresh fruit and vegetables in the world. Exporter and not producer, but we export most of it. We are not very, very clever about that, apparently. So it's about just delivering. So here it doesn't matter that much the quality or anything like that, because people just get to deliver the product. And then what I learned in US is And also in Europe, they are scared of introducing new technology. You know, when I talk to people here, they are like, oh, no, I just want to keep doing my business because I'm not losing that much percentage. I went to a company that claimed to have only 0.5 of recalls food, you know, that they are producers. And I thought, that's interesting. Either they are lying, or or that 0.5% is still could be still millions of euros or dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned in US is that it's all about producing, mass producing, and delivering, and but they are willing to explore solutions to improve their productivity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that much about the environment or anything like that. It's more about, how can I lose less money, you know, because I use more of my production, or I can produce more. In Europe, it's more, if you tell them about the environment, they would probably pay attention more. And in China, is everything together. So depends on where you are. I saw companies that they were just covering this fresh garlic. They had these trailers full of fresh garlic. You know, this is this with the
scallions.
Yeah. I don't know if it is fresh garlic itself, but they were just putting that in the trailer without pallets, without crates, and put in a blanket
in China,
but literally. In China, like a blanket, the one that you have in your couch, on top of it. And they were super happy with that. And then you go to another company and you see the most advanced technology you've ever seen, you know. So it's a very heterogeneous...
That makes sense, and I think there's definitely a good point about, which I think most people would agree on, is that... the US versus Europe, right? In the US, they are pretty open to innovative technologies, but I think mostly for improving yield and improving financial gains, and Europe is more, I would say, and focused on the environment. So I agree with that for sure.
Yeah, also the law is forcing lately the things here to turn a little bit towards more environment friendly and this all sustainable development goals.
Yeah, well, it's great. The government in Europe is taking a more active role, I would say, than in the US.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Noah, do you have any thoughts?
Certainly. And what you'd ordinarily also see is that food standards are generally just higher in the EU. There are more requirements to not use certain things, to make sure that only food is being only produced in certain ways, or that certain techniques or technologies that are damaging to health and the environment aren't used. So the EU is usually used, I think, by some pretty smart groups in the US as a real benchmark, as a high waterline for how to far more sustainably and more intelligently and produce less waste and do a huge variety of things, which the US system is not doing, chiefly because the US system is controlled by very, very few companies who, exactly as Ricardo mentioned, are really focused on driving up profits and not much else. And the reason that they can do what they're doing, hopefully I can shed some light here, is that they're chiefly focused on making sure that the fewest number of producers can do most of the work, so it's easier to centralize the control. It's much easier for a small number of companies to control what goes on if they can each be massive producers, right? So there's less complexity. And overall, they have an easier time understanding what's going on and sort of negotiating bulk pricing in various ways.
You're right, yes. And the majority of the producers here in Spain are small producers, and they have to get together in cooperatives. Mm-hmm. And there have been some public complainings, people, the farmers taking their tractors in the city. To complain about the money that they receive, because sometimes it gets diluted in the supply chain and they usually don't even cover what it costs to them. And the government recently changed the law to help this a little bit. There are still things that they need to change, but it's like they don't have the power. I don't feel they have the same power that they have in US, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the law and companies in the US, there's a lot of entanglement here because of regulatory capture and who's actually governing whom. So it's fascinating to see when small parties can actually have an impact in Europe. And here that would be much, much, much more challenging. And what actually usually occurs here is that smaller producers simply get bought up or outcompeted by the larger producers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But is there an advantage to having... So what's the advantage from like a cold chain standpoint of having more smaller producers versus larger producers?
No, there is no advantage.
No advantage.
That's why they have to...
Okay.
The proper equipment is expensive and they have to get together in cooperatives.
Okay.
If they want to evolve and, you know, on these days that we are living, they need technology, and for technology you need money. And
yeah.
By technology, I'm not talking about like the latest software for something like that. I'm talking about these machines to cool down the food, from to do the pre-cooling and everything that a small producer cannot afford by himself. Mm-hmm. They have to get together and do things more efficiently. Because by yourself, you're achieving nothing.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. I wasn't sure if I was right there. I was kind of trying to counter Noah a little bit in that, like, some centralization actually, you know, is necessary for an effective supply chain. Right. You do need like capital for these new technologies, and that actually does simplify the supply chain in many ways.
Well, yeah. Sure, it certainly can simplify things, but at the same time, you're reducing the average person's ability to have an impact on their own livelihood because you're making it corporate controlled. So one must sort of pay attention to the fact that you have to focus on the real locus of authority, right? You have to make sure that what you're doing is considering the human in that supply chain. And it's much easier for the human to have an impact on their own life when they're a small producer.
So there's probably a balance there, a good balance there. I just thought it was interesting, yeah, that you said even in Spain, you know, they get together in cooperatives because that's easier. So now we're a little bit on sort of a political tangent. But I want to get back to like a little bit more of the details about Ricardo, like, what kind of specific technologies that you've worked on have been most exciting and interesting to you, like the sensors or sort of the shelf life software? What's your favorite? I mean, basically just what's your favorite supply chain, cold chain technology you've worked on?
The best thing would be software. And mm-hmm. I mean software because since I started working on this, since the internships in the university, my bachelor's and master's in Madrid,
mm-hmm.
the hardware is being the same, basically. So
yeah,
there was important at some point, but then the Chinese people took over, you know, the market, and basically you just need to buy the cheapest sensors out there or devices, and just develop your software, because that's the most powerful thing, the software, because you can buy... There's no point on developing the best hardware because Chinese are going to make it cheaper and you can use other hardware. So the hardware, for me, the most important thing is wireless technology that is able to connect a specific point in the supply chain to the cloud, and then access to the data. Doesn't have to be in real time itself, like all the time checking what's going on, because it's pointless. But in the critical points during mm-hmm. the harvest, that the pallets could be under a lot of pressure because there is hot weather, and the trailers could not have the frequency that they would need to cool down the product, or when you are loading a trailer, or when you are unloading a trailer. Those critical moments is when this technology is required to be effective. I'm saying wireless because I've seen people throwing a data logger in a trailer, and then they have to go catch it, connect it with a USB, and that's happening today in many companies. And they have to check, they have to print the temperature curve and then decide what happened, or I mean, if it was too high or too low. So that's why if you're able to develop a software that can collect all that data,
yeah,
and you are able to visualize that in an interface online, the moment the trailer arrives to the distribution center, for example, you already know what's going on there. And if on top of that you add some estimation or some prediction software that is able to predict the remaining shelf life of the product based on the handling, mm-hmm. and the temperature and the humidity and other inputs,
mm-hmm.
that's wonderful. That's the software for me is the key.
Great, thanks. So the shelf life is really, I just keep coming back to that. I mean, I guess that's sort of this core component of like a cold chain, and a food cold chain and food waste, right? I mean, just you're always basically focused on increasing the shelf life, and by doing that you're by default basically reducing food waste. Would you say that's true?
Yes, mm-hmm. but there is a concept above that, mm-hmm. and is because the shelf life is what it is. I mean, I have seen in some studies that I have done romaine hearts lasting 80 days, which is like, I was like, what is going on with this? This is, you know, this is like immortal lettuce. I mean,
yeah.
It's not gonna die. It's not rotting. It's perfect. So you cannot take that like as a normal, that's not normal.
Yeah.
And also, so what I mean is that the shelf life is what it is on average.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can measure, the key here is measure shelf life in key points, and assessing what is the factors that are reducing that average shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find them, you can target and work on helping to reduce those the impact of those factors. And at the end, the idea of food waste is not really, the supermarkets don't like that. So what I mean is, like, above everything is the freshness, how the consumer is perceiving this freshness of the product,
mm-hmm.
which is also helping the supermarkets, because if you go to a supermarket and everything is fresh and it's basically constantly fresh, and you find the freshness constant in that supermarket, it's like, okay, I know if I buy lettuce here, it's going to last 5 days. So I can go there and I know that I have at least 5 days of freshness of this lettuce being fresh at my home.
Yeah.
One of the results of that, let's say, is that you end up wasting less food.
Mm-hmm.
Freshness is an indicator of shelf life.
Right.
Certainly. I mean, there's a lot of the world that now operates with a real sense of manipulation of shelf life, at least in the U.S. here. It's, and we could talk about that, but there's a lot of produce that during the cold chain gets its shelf life manipulated, either by being treated with some sort of chemical or gas treatment, or just being processed in a different way. But it's a really different way of thinking about how the food goes from farm to table than you'd see at a farmer's market. And that's one of the reasons you get those creepily red ripe tomatoes. That is not a mistake. They don't come off the plant looking like that. And so there's a lot of things that are happening during that supply chain treatment that I think the average person's not even thinking about.
Yeah, I wonder if it's, I mean, I wonder if it's like that in Europe, though. I mean, I wonder if during the cold chain process in Europe, if there's less sort of chemical treatments or Do you, could you speak to that, Ricardo?
I don't think they apply too many things during the supply chain process. I don't think they apply too many things.
Oh, you don't? You don't?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, and but there are some things that, for example, you mentioned tomatoes and also citrus, oranges, mm-hmm. for example, to make them travel long distances, this applies for tomatoes, since they are soft, right? You have to harvest them when they are almost green. So, mm-hmm. but nobody likes green tomatoes, then you have to apply some gas to make them red, mm-hmm. to look, you know, attractive. Yeah, ethylene, to look more attractive to the consumer. And there are some treatments that are coming out lately, more natural. I don't know if you have heard about Appeal Science. Hustle. Yeah, those are natural things that you can actually apply to the product that are natural and not harming the humans, let's say. But I think the most of the things that are applied are in the field.
Yeah.
Not that much after mm-hmm. you harvest the product.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, no, I'm a fan of Appeal Sciences.
You know, I heard something. I don't know if it was specifically related to Appeal Science, but it's like if you apply that to avocados, you can actually, it could be another treatment. The person that told me is an avocado producer, but they don't have experience with Appeal. So some treatments can actually block the process of ripening of avocados, and you know, you have to harvest the avocado green. And then you can naturally induce it like it's a fruit that is actually ripening outside mm-hmm. the tree. And some of these treatments block that and you cannot longer ripe that avocado. So you have to sell it green and, you know, it's not as tasty as and creamy as a ripe avocado.
So you're saying it would block the ripening so much that it would never ripen?
Exactly. Yes.
Wow.
You have a stone.
Wow. I think it, at least in the US, you would find a surprising amount of people who've never tasted a fresh, organically grown avocado and for whom that might not matter, which I find sad.
Yeah. And even in the tomato is the biggest, you know, example, the greatest example for me, because my family always had, or some part of my family always had some like a garden with some vegetables and fruit, and so I know what a tomato being harvested at the right time, I know how it tastes, and mm-hmm. and it's amazing how some people don't know how it tastes because they have never seen it, you know.
So you definitely would say that you think that a tomato that goes through a cold chain and is ripened by ethylene tastes different. What is your sort of idea around like local supply chains? I mean, or yeah, just sort of local food, or do you think that we're going toward an era where more people are eating more locally?
I hope so.
You hope so? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally positive about that because there is a change on the mentality and the generation.
Yeah.
And I think we are more aware of all of these things, the positiveness on that. And I checked the calendar to see what is the fruit of the season. And I like to buy that because, among other things, it tastes better when it is the season of apples. They taste better, or when it's the season of whatever, because it's you have more chances to have it fresh. And
yeah.
And I don't understand why I need to have something mango when it's not the season of mangoes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make mango special anymore. So I my grandmother probably never ate pineapple in her life until the 60s or 70s, you know. And that's fine. And they were aware of the taste of everything. And then all these generations in between, that they want everything. I mean, I want everything. I use Amazon, of course. But we are more aware of this thing, I think. And I'm totally okay with that. I support the local, you know, growers and the for the footprint and everything, less footprint and the seasonality of the produce.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think that will affect sort of like the global supply chain? Like where, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen fast or, you know, but maybe we'll start exporting and importing fewer food, you know, across borders? Or, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably if people stop buying avocados from Peru here in Spain when there's no season of avocados, probably they will start reducing the exporting, importing thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking avocados, but it applies to anything. I know there are lots of things behind that, between politics, agreeing that,
yeah,
I'm going to buy you this amount of food and blah, blah, blah. But I would think that there's going to be more rationality on this, and people are buying more what is local and not whatever. Even if we are just aware of what we are buying, it's a big step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, we certainly agree with that. I mean, it's the best supply chain is the shortest supply chain, and what we've certainly seen is that it only gets more complicated and less sustainable the farther you get away from the farm, from the connection that exists between people and their food. So it's truly crazy that we can get anything we want at any time. That understanding of food is itself wasteful because it encourages massive transportation networks, and you're just, even a perfect one is not going to be able to protect every single thing that gets moved.
Yeah, but I mean, but then, right, within this system that we have, a way to make a supply chain, a longer supply chain, more sustainable, is to be able to reduce waste, right?
Yeah, it's what Noah said, I believe, right? I mean,
yeah,
if you travel less with a couple of trailers of whatever produce, you are reducing the chances to spoil the food.
Okay.
And
so have you, like, been working with people to try to shorten supply chains as one way to reduce food waste?
I don't think I could force anybody to. I mean, they have their contracts and they want to. Everything we do, any step we take to improve the supply chains, even if it is short or long, is helping reducing the food waste,
right,
and improving the freshness of the product.
Right. I mean, this is right. The decision has to be made at both a consumptive and productive level. What's going to actually get grown, and people have so far determined that they're going to keep consuming things out of season, so things are going to keep getting produced out of season, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see changes on the supermarket. Now it's more clear what you're buying, you know.
Yeah,
everything is labeled now, like, this is coming from Peru, this is blah blah blah, and you have supermarkets and you have markets, and is markets here is a place where there is a fruit store, there is a meat store, there is a fish store, and everything, you know, but it's not owned by a supermarket, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there you have a professional, and you go there and you ask, what's the fruit of the season? And they tell you this one. And I hear more and more people asking that and leaning towards that seasonality, because I think there is a change on the mentality.
Yeah.
But if people are demanding more local products, we will get more local products. I don't think it's going to disappear, like,
mm-hmm,
being able to eat a pineapple out of season. And it's more expensive. I don't get that. I mean, it's such a big difference between something that is from this season right now is a lot cheaper than something that the same thing,
mm-hmm,
out of season, that I'm not wasting my money in because I can eat, I can substitute whatever at the end we are eating, fiber, proteins, you know, that kind of things, and we can survive combining different foods. We don't need to eat pineapple all year round.
Yeah.
I think most people would be super surprised, even in the U.S. here. I mean, I can speak to a little bit of this in San Francisco, where we're certainly lucky, but when they're in season, I can buy local, organic, ethically farmed, delicious avocados cheaper than I can buy the avocados from Peru that are conventionally farmed with the worst kind of practices and then transported. So it's literally just easier and better to get delicious food in season. It's baffling to me.
Well,
people don't seem to take that advantage.
In California, right, and maybe in Spain.
Right, I mean, where there
the,
is food
the problem
grown.
Is
right.
that in certain climates, it's not true. But yes, in many cases, yes, I think that's true. And I just wanted to agree with Ricardo's point about that there's more transparency in the food system now and like in supermarkets and things like that, telling consumers. I mean, it's still a growing movement and it's not everywhere, but there is more than there used to be in terms of telling consumers where things came from.
In California, that exists. In the average grocery store, there is absolutely no sense of where your food comes
well,
from.
Well, okay. What I'm saying is in California and then Europe in general.
Yes.
I think we're moving systems. Toward that in the U.S. Yes, we're not there yet. And I think Europe is ahead of us with the transparency in terms of where stuff is coming from. But when we do that, and I think it's as the cultural shift continues, it does empower people. And it will fully create sort of a cultural change that will force companies to change their supply chains a bit.
No, I was saying that I would say I like California. I've been there several times, and is the state that I find more similar to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So now could you tell us a little bit more about the software that you've been working with and your specific research? I would love to hear a little bit more about that. And how it can help maybe improve the supply chain.
I want to connect with before harvest, the software, because you can start collecting data from the moment you harvest. But the ideal thing, and this is what is going to happen in the near future, is you start putting sensors in the plant and measuring every single parameter, and that's happening, and it's fully developed right now, and I know some companies that are already doing that, you know, checking what's the requirement of water for that plant, for that vineyard, for that tomato plant and everything. And they can actually predict what is going to be the production of that year, of that day, based on the climate, based on, you know, some parameters of the plant, based on other years, you know, production and everything. They can predict how much is this farm going to produce today, for example. And that's crazy. They have tons and tons of data. But after that, there is nothing. I mean, you put the tomatoes in a trailer and you deliver them. And then luckily, if you have some sensors, and then you rely your product that you're being taking care of it for a long time, and you put a lot of money in just one little sensor at the end of a trailer. But if from the moment you harvest, you start putting these sensors and collecting data and analyzing this data and measuring everything, you know, the power of big data here,
yeah.
You know, predicting what's going to happen, applying other techniques like measuring quality, but in terms of freshness, not the quality that USDA is measuring, that is more for like whether this looks nice or not, or so I'm not gonna take it because some strawberries can look ugly and still be delicious, and many other products, right?
Yeah.
And when you base everything on freshness and you measure towards having best freshness, and you put everything into artificial intelligence, you know, machine learning and everything, software, and you are able to display that to a customer or to yourself, the producer or the distributor or anything. That's the most powerful thing, because you know what is exactly happening to that product, and there is when you can predict the food waste that is going to happen, or you can avoid that, or you can better, you know, do intelligent logistics to ship this pallet that is about to be wasted locally, or ship it in a longer distance if it is gonna, if you know that it's gonna last longer. So for me, the software is the most powerful thing, and the machine learning and all this big data.
Yeah, no, that's great. I really like you, though, you gave specific examples of like even putting sensors in plants and stuff like that. So it's really the sensors being able to be track the food throughout the supply chain, but in combination then with taking that data from those novel sensors to create data that's really, really useful in terms of looking at a food supply chain or a cold chain and then reducing the food waste from there. So yeah, I really liked how you talked about that. And I just had a tangential question. So how do you actually measure, how do people measure freshness of fruits and vegetables? Is there like a measure, quantitative measure of that?
No, and that's the most interesting thing of what
okay.
I do.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad I stumbled upon something interesting.
Yeah, it's the most innovative thing, because nobody's taking care of that. I mean, like I'd say, people are trying to deliver whatever product on time, and they don't pay much attention to the freshness. So I talked to companies and to understand what's their point of view. And the problem here is, if you are a producer, you just look at the quality of your product on your side, right? So you don't look beyond that. And if you are a grocery, you look at the product on your side. So you don't look before that, you know. And at home, we are, all different kind of people, and we don't learn that in the school. Nobody told us how to manage the product at home. So the thing is to look in the whole supply chain from the start to the end. And that's the only way we can understand the whole thing. I mean, and what you have to do is to measure freshness in different parts to see what's the whole story of that product. And the way you measure freshness is to basically, and UC Davis has a great database of what is fresh and not, and I use that a lot. And it's fantastic, because any product you find, you get there and you get some parameters of strawberries, for example, and the dryness, the calyx, the color, all these parameters that you can check when it's fully fresh and when it's decayed. And I can send you some scientific papers about one of the persons that I is my mentor in all this freshness study. That is, she's Cecilia Nunes from she's Portuguese, but is working in University of South Florida, and she's an expert in strawberries, and she told me everything I know about the strawberries, and how to look at the strawberries from the freshness point of view. And all these parameters that you can measure, you have to find the parameters. And sometimes the producer, they know they care about one parameter, but they don't know how to measure it. Mm-hmm. So the key is to see these parameters across time, and then give them a number, a grade, and put them in a software. And then when you have everything in the software, then you can do your analysis and everything. But the key is to transfer what you see in the fruit or the vegetables into numbers. And you have to search for the different parameters that are determining the decay of the product. So every product is different, but basically there are some parameters that are common, like dryness, shriveling in strawberries, color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be great if you could share some of those papers. We'll put them. We always love when people share with us some scientific papers.
Absolutely. And I think the average person has no real sense of how their food is graded in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, because this is not a common practice in the industry.
Okay. So this is kind of what you're trying to add to the industry, and
yes, you would say. Yes,
this is your really area of expertise.
In the last 5 years, so half of my professional career, I've been doing this.
Yeah.
So combined to cold chain. But yes, this is not applied in the industry. This is only applied, I mean, not a common practice. Now, yes, because myself and a few others are doing this. But companies are basically, like I was saying, just to myself.
Yeah.
US companies, for example, they just follow US guidance and they just care about how pretty or how marketable the product is, and they don't pay much attention in the parameters that are actually indicating the shelf life, remaining shelf life or freshness of the product.
Mm-hmm. So I guess last question that I had, just considering we're in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic right now, what are like the major issues that emergency like this, how does that really affect the food supply chain, and how is that affecting it in this situation?
What I have seen is that there is a change on behavior of consumers. That's the first thing, and the main problem I think is we are all at home at the moment, and we are only allowed to go out for doing some grocery shopping, and there are people that are more careful and other people that aren't careful, and supermarket is a place where you don't think about, but you end up touching I don't know how many products, I mean all kind of products, all kind of bars, the chart, everything, you could end up spreading the virus, right? And now home deliveries are fully blocked here, for example. It's almost impossible to have your groceries being delivered home. And that's the major chain, I think, because there is no problem with supply. I mean, all the companies are working full-time, harvesting their product, delivering. Probably is even better right now, the food supply chain, than before, because there's no traffic. Trailers can move freely. There is no limitations.
Mm-hmm.
There is. I went to the supermarket a couple of times, and I've never seen so many products in the displays and everything. It was perfect, and everybody was there committed to do their job. And for me, those are heroes that are taking the risk for me and others to have food and to be able to eat every day. And the problem is more in the consumer side, like many other times in the food waste, for example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great. Thanks for that perspective.
I think we've seen the same thing here. It's all about people changing their buying habits and being told to do something in bulk. And I think that when you leave just a grocery store open, that sort of becomes people's only chance to get out and do something. It's a pastime now, not just a requirement.
Yeah, exactly. There are some egoist people here that are going 5 times a day to pick stupid small things just to go out. And I guess they are not aware of the danger that
they've putting on. That's not good. Everyone stay home. That's the message now.
It's interesting that you said that grocery deliveries are not happening there. I mean, that's still happening here. So that's
No, it is happening.
Oh, it is. Okay.
But there is such a high demand that
right.
either Amazon or any supermarket here is fully booked. So,
oh, right, right, okay.
Right, yeah. That is also our experience here, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Crazy, crazy. But the food supply chains are, in a way, better. You said they're in a way they're running better because there's less traffic and...
I'm pretty sure that's happening, yes.
Yeah,
yes. So, or maybe we always had the ability to increment this demand that we are probably having, right? Because people are buying extra for just in case. But there is no need to be afraid. We have plenty of food. We have so much food that we actually can afford to waste food. So there is another message that I would send. Is please don't overbuy and waste at your home, because that would be a mistake also.
Right, right, for sure. It's easy to like panic and buy a lot of food and then not eat it all, and that, you know, that's definitely not helping the problem of food waste.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much. Yeah, I feel like we got a really in-depth view into the food supply chain, and that's what I was looking for. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything else you would want to say to our listeners?
No, just what you just say right now. I mean, stay home, don't overbuy. We will try to educate, right, you guys and myself in my side, people, to don't waste food. We can start things from home by being more, aware of the problem. It's just a good start.
Yes. Yeah. Certainly. So, you're working on it from the supply chain side, but right, consumer food waste is a really huge problem as well. So each person can make an impact on their own.
That's a great point to make again. Certainly. We can all do our part here. It's more than just not panic buying, but pay attention to what we're actually consuming is always a good idea.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me and for the great questions.
Thanks for joining us, Ricardo. This has been amazing, and we hope to do it again soon. Thank you for listening at home, everyone, and we will have a new episode for you shortly.